Welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we are embracing the journey. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. I so enjoyed meeting my guest today. Jody is an historian. She chaired the Department of Race, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. She was the executive director of her Regional Diversity Council, and her mission is to create connection across generations of women and honor the wisdom and spark of us seasoned women. That last part is in her words, and having met her, I verify them as true. My true confession, there's so much there that I can get on my soapbox with. There are a lot of events and issues currently that can be viewed through an historical lens, and it's really easy for discussions there to take on a tint of the political. No apologies, them's the facts. As I always do with guests, I ask Jody if there's anything she wants us to think about as we navigate these decades. Her response was so insightful. Listen now to my conversation with Jody Vandenberg Daves. My guest today is a compilation of so many of the things that I can get on my soapbox about. She creates connection across generations of women. She's an historian. She talks about the importance of older women in the workplace, our wisdom, what we're still contributing, motherhood. You get the picture? And I love her comment, no matter who we are or what we're doing, we can understand ourselves in the flow of history. None of us exist in a vacuum, and we need to know what came before so we can place ourselves in the here and now and make informed decisions about today and tomorrow. I originally put intelligent, but I thought let's just downgrade it to informed decisions. An historian I interviewed a couple of years ago also added our ability for critical thinking into the mix. Now, Jody suggested this would be a powerful conversation. I'm up for it. Are you? I'm
I
talking
am
to the listener.
excited.
Yeah, talking to the listener as well. Jody Vandenberg Daves, welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we are embracing the journey.
It's so great to be here. Thank you for that kind introduction.
Oh, well, as I said, I'm going to be on a soapbox a little bit through the conversation. Now, between your studies, your career, and your message to me, there's a bunch of things that I do want to unpack. So I hope I don't sound too disorganized because I'm going to sort of hop around a little bit.
Sounds good.
Now, the mainstay of just about everything I read about you is history. I've long maintained that what came before is often responsible for where we are today, whether it's in our own life or larger scale, like institution and politics. You're a history professional. Talk to us about how you see the history in our present.
Oh, where to begin?
You
Where to
choose.
begin? I guess I will just step back even and say that a historical perspective and awareness is so grounding for me. It's fundamental to my survival of this very difficult historical moment is to know that we've been through really hard times before as humans and as, segments of the human population. And so history is grounding because a lot of things repeat themselves. And I anchor in as well in the history of activism, social justice work, people pushing back against systems, people raising powerful questions, finding ways to get their voices heard. And there's so many people commenting on the rise of authoritarianism in the United States that I won't belabor that point because you can hear it everywhere, and I don't dispute it. I guess I will point out that what inspires me is seeing that creative ways that people are pushing back against that. And, to bring it to a little bit more focused point around some of the work that I do around the workplace and leadership, people are having to find courage in this moment. And I hope that they can look to kind of people in the past and to their elders who are still here to find that courage, because part of the way history lives is in people who've lived through different things. And we have kind of we've long had a youth-focused and consumer-oriented culture that makes us a little bit throwaway about elders, and I say that about the dominant culture in the United States and North America, not, there are many groups within our country and larger continent that do honor elders. But our dominant culture, we tend to not try to even get those stories and perspectives. And so I like to think about some of those things around how history lives and can be a valuable resource to us. I don't know if that kind of gets at your question, but feel free to keep digging.
Well, there was a few things that came to mind, and you talked about like elders and things like that. And just recently, there was that bad earthquake in Afghanistan, and they interviewed a woman who's living in Canada now, and she said, and she's from Afghanistan, and she said, "I'm over 75, but I cannot sit here. I need to go do something." And she's flying back to Afghanistan, and so late 70s, and there's just no stopping her because of what she knows that she can do and what she feels she has to do, I'm sure. So that sort of came to mind. And then you talked about, the asking the difficult questions and things like that. And I look at world events and just I get angry with the press because I think there's a really obvious question to ask here, and you're not asking it. Why are you avoiding going into the hard places? So anyways, it's now there's
Yeah,
this.
and
Go ahead.
well, I was just going to say that this is something that, all my years as a professor, and now in the current work I'm doing and the book I've just that's coming out here on Leading with Courage, I really encourage young people in particular to honor their questions, because the questions that are coming up for them as they come into rules and systems that they didn't make are the questions we need to move things forward. And every generation needs to be asking those burning questions. They feel really burning right now. Climate change, authoritarianism, such a pushback against just the humanity of many of our fellow humans, our immigrants, our transgender people, the rights of women and people of color. The urgency of those questions is so real. But I feel like we often really do need to figure out how to empower young people to ask those questions and then engage with people with different points of view and different experiences that can kind of work together.
Well, and I mean, I think sitting just outside our conversation is ageism, and I find that I love engaging my 15-year-old grandson, who will ask me any question in the world. I shouldn't say this out loud, but I sometimes, call his mother later and say, "Just so that you know what this conversation was about, he asked me about this or whatever." Just so that everybody's on the same page there. But he'll ask me sort of my view, given my age, about something that's going on, and some of those big things, whether it's American politics or the environment or whatever. But then to turn it around and ask him how at what he sees at 15, at age 15, and make that a dialogue, and it's really interesting, and I'd like to say that I'm sharing some wisdom, but but it's also interesting because a lot of young people do have wisdom, and with adding a bit of history into the wisdom, it can be a really interesting conversation, and I don't fear for our future because of that.
Oh, that's beautiful that you're doing that. And we need to replicate that in lots of different ways. I mean, I argue we need to replicate some of that in the workplace as well. Yeah, that's really, really great that you're doing that.
Yeah, we're going to get to the workplace in a minute. Now, there's variations on how this is written, but those who forget history or something are doomed to repeat it. I think the word doomed is a little strong, but how do you feel about that statement?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
It's just true. We need more history education, and we need more historical awareness, and we need to not separate ourselves from the past. And this is part of the conversation that's really going on in the US, is like things that happened in Nazi Germany are happening here. And there's a way in which that Nazi Germany piece has always been put on this shelf as this unique, exceptional thing. and distant from us, but it's not distant. We're still humans, and we operate in some of the same patterns, and authoritarianism operates in some of the same patterns. So we need to not distance ourselves from that. And not only are we doomed to repeat the past, but we're doomed, or we're impoverished, I guess you could say, by not being able to learn the lessons from the past. And as a historian of women, and my big sort of book in the field was The History of Motherhood. It's called Modern Motherhood and American History. And as a historian of women, I'm looking at trends that often go on in the background that are part of what we need to know. And those include women have been active in transforming families, partly through actually limiting how many children they're going to have and controlling that, through their labor force participation, through their political and community participation and activism. Women have been transformational in often quiet ways. And so we not only need to learn history with a capital H, we need to learn about the histories of people who we didn't used to think about as part of history. I know, in our lifetimes, of course, we know that history is not just about great men, but still, there's ways in which the field prioritizes kind of masculine notions of what counts as history.
Well, it's interesting you talk about motherhood and women in general, probably, because I've got a book on my Kindle that is it's something that women in the settling, I think it's the Canadian prairies, and how land was allocated to men, but and there was requirements in order they didn't buy it, but they worked for it, and they had to have certain structures and this whole thing. And sometimes those men would die. And what the women did with the men, but what the women did without the men to make sure that they kept those homesteads for their families and their income and their sustenance, basically, is yeah, it's just don't ever underestimate the role of women today or yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. And so through most of history, so little social or economic or political power, and yet still being resourceful, being resilient. I mean, the history of motherhood is just so much about that, and that's one of the things when I taught this class over and over again, the history of motherhood in the US, and it's finding those ways in which women creatively, resourcefully make things work, even though they're not going to be taken as seriously in the public spaces where they need to represent their property holdings or whatever. They're going to find a way to make it work.
And yet, in some developing nations, the people who are being granted those business development loans or whatever are the women because they know the power of a woman once she commits to creating something for her community or her family or the world, perhaps. It's like, don't get in her way.
Yeah, and thankfully now we know more about that because of so many feminist researchers for the last 30 or 40 years. I used to teach a history of feminist thought as well, and I think it was around the 1980s or maybe 70s when we first actually counted women on the planet. Like, think about that, just to even know how many there were. And women were so often subsumed under the male head of household, and their economic contributions were so often devalued. And now, as you say, we have enough research and enough people who've taken that research seriously to know that if you want to have economic drivers and community builders in economic development, you want to be making sure women have access to those funds. It's not, it empowers women, but it also empowers communities and families.
Right. We could spend a whole hour just discussing women. just going back to history and things is I'm 70, and in my notes I've got I'm only 70,
You're
and
only 70. I love
yeah, I
it.
see media comments or political talk about some of the things going on today, and I think we've been here before. And it was only the 70s or the 80s, and that's recent history. Like, do some research. Like, they just spout off their mouth, and it's like, oh my goodness, it would take you an hour of your life to go and dig and you don't
What
do
kinds of
that.
things in particular are you thinking we've been here before and people need history? What's driving
Oh,
your
you're putting
question
me on the spot. Other than,
about
well, no, it's just that
that?
I think it happens often enough.
Yeah.
And I think about it in terms, I'm not going to come up with specifics on the spur of the moment, but I know discussing things with my 15-year-old grandson to say, well, you know, this is exactly what we went through in the, you know, 19th, early 70s or something like that. You know, because I was an adult in my in the early 70s, and I it's not like this, although childhood memory, sure. I can remember growing up on a Canadian Air Force station, and we still in the early 60s had air raid sirens going off, and we would race off and get into the shelters and things like that. You know, so now I hear some of the things that are going on in especially other parts of the world, but even more locally. And I'm going like, oh my God, like another generation has to live through this, this fear and children and you know, I guess you think of the Ukraine and it's like,
Oh
oh my
my
God.
goodness, the traumatizing experiences and even the fear experiences. I mean, I've thought about this some because I'm kind of an elder Gen X. I was born a couple years later than the baby boom cut off, so I'm not a boomer, but close to that. And you know that, but it makes a difference because I didn't grow up with that. No air raids and no bomb shelter. We were done with that by the time I was in school in the 1970s. And now the kids with their shooting drills in the United States, and that it's heartbreaking and terrifying. And so there was a like a I feel like I we had a little bit of a charmed generation there, but that also raises the question of what are people's formative generational experiences. You know, I think that's another way we can foster intergenerational conversations and access history is what is formative about people's fears and about their hopes connected to the time period when they grew up, as well as a lot of, you know, specific factors about their identities and culture and gender and background and things like that.
Well, I can remember probably late 70s, maybe early 80s, listening to somebody who was a fighter. And I'm going to be really broad here because memory does not serve, somewhere in the Mideast. East. And the interviewer said, if peace arrived tomorrow, what would you do? And his response was, I would go find another war. Because that's what he believed in so strongly is the power of the fight. And I'm thinking, oh my God, like to believe that strongly, what was his childhood like? That, you know, and it's just like, my goodness, like I just, that's one of my big fears is that a new generation is going to grow up with a warring reality and only know that reality. So you know, that becomes what they do.
And how do we foster resilience to overcome, you know, to move forward in life after having those traumatic childhood experiences and present alternatives to how we can live. And I think that's another thing with history is I always think about what is the social imagination, you know, of different time periods about what's possible and what are we fighting for? You know, early 20th century, for example, there was a lot of labor activism and how could we, you know, have a situation in which the fruits of the industrial economy were shared among people, and how could we, you know, people in that time period talked about, well, you have a soldier's pension, why don't you have a mother's pension to honor the work of bringing life into the world, and the state should support that. And you know, that's just a piece of social imagination we've kind of lost. But if we, you know, that's part of the fun of studying history is like, what did people think might be possible, you know? And yeah.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that because you did prompt another memory of I was having my kids in the mid 80s, and it's like that's when they were starting to try to put a monetary value on what a woman did within the home. And I was a stay-at-home mom for a number of years, and it was like, okay, if you want to pay me for this home and family management job that I'm doing, I'm all over it. But
Yes, thank the feminists for raising that, you know, and raising comparable worth and all the jobs that women were doing and are still doing where there's all the that are devalued because women are doing them, and because they're different sets of skills. Like, operating a forklift is different than answering email and phones and things like that. And back then they didn't have email, but in the 70s and 80s they pushed this comparable worth idea that, like, actually these are equally sophisticated skills, but one that's done by women and seems to be an extension of what women do in the home, connecting and communicating, is devalued. And how are we thinking about how wages and salaries are affiliated with that? So, we've been lucky to live through times when feminists have allowed us to name and claim more of what women are bringing and what's being devalued and what could be valued more.
Yeah. One more personal story is I remember taking just a little weekend away, probably went to visit my parents without family. And a friend of mine bumped into my former husband and said, "Oh, how's it going?" And, because she knew I was out of town. And he goes, "Oh my God, like I had to get the kids to this and I had to do that. And then there was meal prep and then there was this." And she just looked at him and she started to walk away and she said, "Oh, you mean the stuff Agnes does every day?" And
Yes.
actually, that story came from him. So to give him credit there.
Yes, it's so it still feels kind of revolutionary to name those things sometimes. And in teaching my intro to gender, race, and class in the United States courses, or my history of motherhood, I would have students, I'd kind of list all these different activities and things that needed to happen, tasks, regular tasks, weekly, daily, or whatever. And I would have them kind of go, which gender in your household primarily did these things? Was it a male task? Was it a female task? Was it a shared task? Or if there was a non-binary person in your home, or however your family was configured, but you still kind of had the general buckets of, like, was it tended to be this gender or that gender on average that did this? And I would just tally all the responses on the board. I would put the, on the whiteboard, and I would put all the tasks, laundry and, shopping for the kids' clothes and meal prep and on and on and on and on, all these legit keeping the family calendar, things that are often really invisible. And it was a social science experiment that always came out the same way. It was like, even with a lot of room for these young people to kind of, say, oh, maybe my dad did more of that than I thought. Maybe it was, I think it was shared, or I want to think it was shared. You'd still just see the evidence on the board. And the one that always came out as a big fat zero or one or two was laundry for men. And, I mean, I always made space for it. Like, there are differences, and there are men who do a lot of this, and good for them. And, there are different kinds of families, and they're, families with two moms and all that. But we still are seeing a lot of gendered patterns, and we're not necessarily teaching how to subvert that and the impact of that on women's lifelong access to achievement, and on men's sometimes sense of entitlement and disconnect from that. Those are still conversations we really need to have.
So I'm going to tell on myself here is I do occasionally say to, women friends who still maintain a household with other people in it, that, if you really don't like doing that job, do such a crap job of it that nobody lets you do it anymore. Because that's what I often maintain that I'm sorry out there, man, all the men in the audience, but sometimes men seem to do that.
That, well, yeah, there's the, I think it's called learned helplessness.
Oh, okay. That's why you're on the show. Teach us these
And maybe
phrases.
we as women need to learn some more helplessness, or some just like, nope, can't do that, or I'm not good at that, or I'm not good at that anymore, or I resigned from that role. I don't know.
No, you're way better at that. Than you got to pet the ego, I think, a little bit.
There you go.
Oh dear. Okay. We older women know we have a lot to offer, but those who trivialize our history and our potential wisdom, they can treat us to some serious ageism.
Yeah.
Now, I had a guest last week who explained how ageism, and I'd never thought of it this way, ageism in any direction takes away agency from a person. So, can you start with age and wisdom in the workplace? Because you mentioned that earlier.
Yeah. As you're saying, the value and wisdom of older women in the workplace is often overlooked. And I'll step back culturally and say, not only is there ageism, women tend to feel that and have that directed at them more than men. I mean, look at like the relative preponderance of older men in character roles in the media versus older women and the jokes about older women. So there's that. And then there's also just like we were talking about generations earlier. There are a lot of these cultural memes that are move over boomer or okay boomer, all that kind of stuff. And I'm sure you talk about this on the show. But that sets up a dismissiveness about an entire generation. And I'll be honest, when I saw the Saturday Night Live skit, I don't know if you saw it a few years back during COVID, where it was called Boomers Got the Vax. And it was this just skewering of some of the generational privileges of baby boomers. And there was some truth to it, and I know this as a historian. So like, the GNP went up 250% between 1945 and 1960 in the United States, and home ownership was here, and the GI Bill, and all these economic possibilities that the baby boomer generation enjoyed more than, say, millennials and Gen Z. There's truth to that, and so it was very funny, but it also diminishes the possibilities of making connections and knowing, I point out like in my book that older women and people of all genders who are baby boomers may have experienced all kinds of workplace discrimination, lack of ability to talk about mental illness, mental health challenges that is now more prevalent today. If you're gay, probably having to be closeted your entire career. There are challenges that boomers had as well. And so, and then just as humans and traveling the journey, there's just so much we have to learn from one another. So just stepping back with that little bit of context. But yeah, older women in the workplace often have so much institutional or industry knowledge and have been through a lot of different cycles of things. And the wise ones don't say, "Oh, we tried that, it didn't work." They say, "Well, we did something a little bit similar 10 years ago, and here are some of the lessons we learned." But I'm interested in your fresh insights on that. And so there are ways, I think, to, on the end, from the perspective of the older woman, to have some of those conversations. But yeah, we have a kind of a wisdom that you can't really get without some years on you. And it's a wisdom that is very much dismissed by the kind of move over boomer or you've had all the privileges. We need to be approaching older women with questions about their experiences and what they can share. And I think we also need to not be making assumptions about what older women can or cannot contribute. I've sometimes heard from women over 50 that there's an assumption that I'm not very tech savvy, and that's not necessarily true. There might also be an assumption that you're winding down your career, and maybe you're not winding down your career because your nest is finally empty, your family obligations are lessened, and you're excited to lean into your career. So there's a lot of assumptions that can kind of get made. There are a number of challenges that older women in the workplace experience, and it's not just the ageism that we're talking about here, but also, in my oral histories for my book research, I had women tell me, "I've lost all my mentors in the workplace. People are retiring, the people older than me, the people that grounded me." And so the struggle to deal with that absence and seek, is it staying in touch with those mentors even though they're not in the workplace anymore? Is it finding more peer mentorship? Is it learning to do reciprocal kinds of mentoring relationships with younger people? Those are some of the things that I see older women trying to do. But I think that's a powerful thing to realize is that that we don't really make space for is that there's loss and grief even in the workplace for the way things change as we age.
I've often maintained that sort of the ultimate retirement plan package for a company is to have some sort of a job share so that you spend a few years figuring out who has the potential to fill shoes that will become empty within several years or whenever, and have them work together because a younger person might bring skills or something to an older person, so they can extend their career another couple of years, but that older person is going to be mentoring with either history or anything within the company, or even the full picture. Like sometimes you only get the full picture of a company or a business by being there over the years. And a young person starts and they only know what's within their bailiwick, as opposed to the entire corporate culture.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm a big promoter of storytelling about our lives and our career journeys in the workplace and how we connect in the workplace. And I guess I'm also thinking what's important in for people of all ages is I talk about cultural humility in some of my work and diversity, equity, inclusion, but I think we also need age humility, and that includes for us who are over 50, because again, historian in context, but I start my book talking about these young people are up against it in ways that are just that can be really difficult for us to understand because there were some things that we never thought we would lose that they've grown up not feeling like they might ever have. And that could include home ownership or a college education that doesn't have $60,000 worth of debt if you're in the United States, or, freedom to access reproductive rights, a stable climate. Just some functioning government. I mean, I'm definitely giving a United Statesian perspective on some of these things here, but those are things that like feed a lot of insecurities for young people. And how do we approach them with the humility to understand where they're coming from? On the other hand, we also really haven't taught young people and middle-aged people, for that matter, how to access that wisdom from older people. And I think you're right about job sharing or multi-generational kind of project teams, promoting those intergenerational conversations in the workplace and outside the workplace is important, like you're doing with your grandson. How can we replicate some of that?
My brother actually calls it the grandmother effect. And he feels that he can see the difference in children who have had an active relationship with a grandparent
I love that.
and those who, are brought up. And this is not disqualifying anything, but maybe a single parent or a super busy parent or a parent that's struggling with all of their own stuff, whether that's mental health issues or finances or anything, health. So as I said, I'm not taking it away, but as I said, my brother calls it, he says he can see when the grandmother effect is around.
There's some research on that too, showing how valuable grandmothers have been to survival in especially difficult times for people. Yeah, it makes sense. And grandmothers are a really, really valuable resource. And how do we, yeah, and how do we think about that? It sort of works in a family context better than how we think about it in the workplace, right? Because nobody in the
For sure.
workplace tends to want to be called a grandmother, right? Because of the demeaning ageist assumptions about that in a workplace. It's lovey and warm in a family. In a workplace, it's demeaning and ageist potentially. So that's
And I think
disrevealing in and of itself when you think about it.
it's interesting because I can remember a situation when I was mid-career as a manager, and a couple of the other managers were complaining about an issue with some employees and how to deal with it. And I remember putting my hand up and saying, can I deal with it? Because all these people need in this specific incident, the incidents, is I'll just be mom and say, we wouldn't ask you to do this within like our institutional, I'm trying to be really vague here, you can tell. While we would never ask you to do this institutional thing in your private life, you shouldn't bring that part of your private life that we're complaining about into institutional life. And to me, it was really simple because you weren't bad mouthing anybody, you weren't making them feel bad about anything. It was just an explanation. And it's just sort of interesting that We probably need another term for it other than grandmothering or mothering, but just that ability to talk about something in a, I don't know. I'm grasping
Yeah,
things here.
no, it's that's really thought-provoking too, because one of the things that many feminists have argued is that the skills of being a mother are very transferable into superpowers in the workplace, whether it's conflict management, emotional agility, dealing with disparate interests and needs, managing time efficiently because you've got a lot going, balancing what I think all leaders need to balance, which is sort of the task orientation of getting things done and the relationship orientation. These are skills that mothers develop all the time, right? And that ability to take different perspectives and have empathy and be nurturing, because we're taught and socialized to be nurturing. Those are all superpowers for team building and for creating psychological safety, which is a big buzzword in the workplace. But when we talk about them as being someone's mom, it's the sexism of the term mom, even, and even more so grandma. Like, I hadn't thought about the grandma part until this conversation. I've thought a lot about the mom part, and I know I have found that as a professor, like being somebody's mom in some way is holding space for them that they need to just kind of move through something, and I, as the generations became, I taught for about 25 years, and so there were a couple different generations in there, right? And the younger people, they're just caring more with the mental health and all that, and part of my job became a little bit of social work, so holding space for them and sort of mothering them a little bit while also keeping my boundaries became sort of part of my skill set, I think. But if I would have called it mothering them, I would have probably demeaned my own professionalism. And what does that say about our culture? And if I'd called it grandmothering them, which, I did not teach long enough to be anybody's grandma. No, that's not really true. It depends on how you do things, but on average, right? I think it would be even more like, just challenging. It's just challenging terminology. I think you're right. Like, how do we both lift up the value of those skill sets that mothers and grandmothers are taught and develop and hone while we're dealing with the sexism of language and perception?
That's your next project, should you choose to
Yeah, there
accept
we
it.
go.
Coming up with the
Yeah, no, I'm going to really be thinking about the
new
grandmother piece. That's so fascinating. Yeah.
vocabulary. Okay, one more question before we move on to, I want to move on to a few things. I was writing my notes and it occurred to me, is ageism a learned thing or is it a product of ego? Or is it something else?
Explain what you mean by a product of ego.
If I can make you feel bad because you're old and therefore not as viable or vital, that builds me up.
Well, in some ways, any kind of ism is that, right? And so, people who some of it is unconscious, yes, and is a learned behavior. I mean, all kinds of bias, racism, sexism, homophobia. I mean, I spent a lot of my career trying to challenge these things and help students and people think critically about them. We're all a product of the biases in our culture, and that includes ageism and the intersection of ageism and sexism, which is part of what we're talking about here, right? So yes, it's learned behavior, but when people practice it, not just mindlessly but aggressively, I think it is, it's territoriality. It's like puffing yourself up at someone else's expense, and it's punching down in some ways whenever you're relying on an ism, whenever you're feeding into that notion that someone is less than because of their age. And I will say too, there's some interesting research suggesting that there's no that that age is can always be a negative thing for women in the workplace. That you just get done being told you're too young, and then you're too old. So it's very cultural, and so yes, there are learned behaviors. Young women have more to prove. There's the confidence gap between women and men is at its biggest in the early 20s, and it really shrinks on average to vanishing points by around 40. Then by the like age 60, research suggests that men are a little bit less confident than women. And yet it's women getting that ageism thrown at them. But women have also been through the school of hard knocks by that point. And so, ageism, oh, that's just the tail end of all the sexism and the other isms that you might have, like you've already had to figure out how to own your own worth when other people can't always see it. And for men, particularly men with privileges around race, sexual orientation, other things, that feeling of someone not taking them quite as seriously can be more new, and more like, whoa, what does that do to my confidence?
Yeah. So in answer to my question, it's all of the above. Okay.
All of the above. Yeah, I could
And
go on and on.
when I talk about ageism too, I do like to explain and just put it out there that ageism goes both ways, up and down. And also we do it to ourselves in terms of that internalized ageism of I'm too old for that sort of thing. And
I agree, and I will say that, I'm find this to be an important and fascinating conversation. And when I was 25, I probably didn't. And I want to just own that. Like I sometimes just remind myself I grew up internalizing a lot of that ageism too. And so, we got to be careful how much we expect of people, right? It's always easier to talk about when you've had some experiences and know, oh, that's what that is, right?
I tell you say so many things that I just want to go off on that tangent, but time is finite.
Yes.
Now, you have a talk that a lot of listeners will identify with, confronting perfectionism and imposter syndrome. Lord knows I am not a perfectionist, and I'm no, what's it called when you're still working on something?
You're well, I kind of call myself a partial and recovering
A
perfectionist.
recovering perfectionist, that's what
Yes.
it is.
Partial as in it's not all domains, and I kind of joke that anyone who's ever cooked with me knows I'm not a perfectionist in how I dice my onions or how I, if you might find the lemon seeds in my hummus, but then there are other areas, right?
So talk about confronting perfectionism.
Well, I love doing that talk or workshop. It tends, I part of what I like to help people think about is how this is partly systemically constructed, how sexism and other systems can make us feel like we have more to prove. I mean, there's research showing that women are more like men are likely to get promoted on the basis of potential, where women have to have accomplishments as well. And these kinds of things about how much harder it is for people of color or women to get taken seriously or promoted or considered to be the natural leaders. There's a lot of research still showing that people tend to think of white men as natural leaders. So if also if you've been in spaces where you feel like you've been made to feel like you don't belong, Jenny Vasquez Newsom in her book Untapped Leadership talks about how as a Black woman, she experienced this a lot as part of her socialization. And so it would make sense that you could develop some imposter syndrome if people have made you feel like an imposter. So that I talk about those systems, but then I also talk about how we can develop self-awareness of those systems, of our particular workplaces. Our workplaces can either mitigate or enhance perfectionism. If you have rigidity, if you have a lack of diversity, if you have lack of transparency around processes and people are in the dark and then they just kind of scurry and try harder and worry about their mistakes all the time, right? So our workplaces can construct that. And then I talk too about how we also need to recognize our own triggers and cycles. So when we're doing something for the first time and it's new, our perfectionism can really ratchet up. When we are trying to push through, we've just been in a cycle of being really generative and now we need to rest, but we're trying to push through it. We can have our perfectionism come through. When we're in a new leadership role, trying out anything new, and especially if we're feeling unsupported in those situations, that's when our perfectionism can come up. So I talk about kind of perfectionism hacks, and that includes really developing that self-awareness and self-compassion, but also teaming up. You know, who can be like your perfectionism mitigation team? How do you keep people in your life who remind you of your value, who allow you space to vent, who don't blame you for having your perfectionism come up and just like work with it with you? How do you avoid too, like over-identifying with your role so much? That because that in of itself, like if you're just some, I found for myself sometimes just a number of hours a week I'd put in would make me just too obsessive about work, and then you can't step back and get the perspective you need. And then I also really encourage women in particular to anchor in their values and purpose and what they bring that is special. Because as women, and if we get on, especially if we get on perfectionistic cycles, we tend to volunteer for everything, or you know, like just feel like if we're good girls and keep doing and doing and doing, we'll get noticed and it'll work out, and then we'll feel better and we won't feel so like imposters. But really, it's our own work to ground in what value we bring. And again, we do need to have people around us reminding ourselves of that. And then I talk too about a growth mindset, because if we over-identify with the idea that I'm a perfectionist, we can really do ourselves a disservice. That is learned behavior to go back to, you know, it's socially created, but it's also learned. And we can develop a growth mindset. We can see here are the areas where I used to be more of a perfectionist, but I found a way forward. And now I have confidence in this area. And know that we can work with ourselves on it instead of just beating ourselves up for being a perfectionist, because I think that's part of the message that gets sent to women all the a lot too, which is just like, well, don't be a perfectionist, don't be a worrier. Well, we're taught that, and we need to get really strong and build that strength with other people to mitigate that, because the research shows too that people who really get in that perfectionism, they don't make as many of the contributions that they actually often want to make, because they're so busy attending to details that they and getting everything perfect that they can't really soar, you know, they can't really innovate. And so it's about really too knowing what do I really want to contribute and why am I here? And I don't come to work to be perfect, you know, like nobody said that was part of the job description. So those are some of the things that we talk about.
I often maintain too that perfect is a moving target.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so
Yeah.
you see, you get to what might be perfect in the moment, but then, oh, actually, I need to do this or that needs, you know, so it's, you know, you drive yourself crazy. A word I've tried to incorporate into my own life in the last couple of years as a recovering perfectionist is that nothing, it's not precious. So to remind myself of like, the world will not change if this isn't done to whatever imaginary standard I think I need. Or my beautiful oak sideboard that I really want to pass on to my children. It's not precious. So, because they don't want it. You know, so if a grandchild spills a drink on it, it's like, let's just clean up the drink. You know,
Yeah, just letting
so.
go.
Yeah, it's just trying to, and precious is the word that I do use a fair bit in my own life as I get older now. So,
And that
yeah.
sounds like the wisdom of age as well, you know, to be able to learn to let things go, to learn, you know, that I think when you're younger, you often feel if I just, you know, follow the step, these steps, and I strive and I strive and I strive, I'll get these outcomes. By the time you're a little older, you haven't gotten everything you've wanted. And you know, you've learned how to let more things go. And I like that it's not precious. It connects to something else I say in that talk or workshop, which is we have to watch our egos. We have to watch our sense of is, you know, our self-importance, like my work product, is it really that important? I mean, if lives depend on it, sure. But if not, maybe not so much, you know. And if you make that so precious, then you hold on to it and you don't let things go out into the world so you can go do the next thing, you know, because you're still hanging on to polishing the gem. And I say that as someone who's about to, it was like putting a book into the world, and that is, it's nerve-wracking. It's definitely nerve-wracking. And yet you have to just jump off the cliff and leap and go, okay, I'm letting this go out into the world. And then what's in my life is some opened up energy to do some other things.
Well, or to do what a friend of mine is now doing is re-releasing the book. If you get feedback or whatever, you want to tweak a few things, or you think you learn something new along the way, and 5 years up the road you want to re-release it, you can do all those tweaks. So yeah, if
That's the
not,
growth
it's
mindset. That's the, I mean, the same is true with other work, right? You get feedback, and learning how to accept and process feedback, I think, is another important thing if we struggle with perfectionism, and having people kind of help us through that, especially, if it's difficult feedback, how to be reminded that feedback is feedback, and some of it's going to be really useful and important to you, some of it's not. How do you work with that?
Dear. Okay. Can we just talk for 3 hours?
It's fun. I love your lengthy conversations. I love how deeply you dig.
Now, in your bio, it says that you love to talk about finding our voices and naming and claiming our superpowers. Talk away.
So, I mean, I've said some of this already in the course of our conversation, but for example, why are working mothers such amazing assets in workplaces? Because we have some of these superpowers that I mentioned, that emotional agility and the kind of context sensitivity, ability to nurture relationships and know that people have different kind of gifts that they bring. I mean, if you have more than one child, you know that, right? So some of those superpowers. But I also, working with a lot of social justice oriented young people, I believe it's a superpower to ask the critical questions. I believe it's a superpower to know how to be an advocate, how to be an ally, how to create, be part of co-creating inclusive spaces, innovating to do things a different way. Those are superpowers. Building connections and relationships are absolutely superpowers. I subscribe to Harvard Business Review. I see, over and over again, I just see that the kinds of things that women are taught to do at work are the exact things that transformational leaders in moments like we're having now of massive change and uncertainty, those are the leaders we need. Men and all genders can do these things too, but we should be following some of the example of the most transformational women leaders, because these tend to be our superpowers, and they can be exploited. Let me just say that. They can be exploited into asking women to do way too much, what many feminists call emotional labor. We can, well, we're good at relationships. Why don't we remember everyone's birthdays and do, and caretaking for family issues and all that, and be the office mom, and why don't we listen to somebody cry or complain over here because that's our job? That can be exploited. In fact, so many jobs that women have been kind of segmented into, customer service, nonprofit, social work, valuable, wonderful roles. But why is there a high burnout rate often? Because that emotional labor gets exploited. So how do we thread the needle and say, let's value that emotional labor, let's value and consider how we sort of compensate people and evaluate their jobs based on their team building, their retention, all those things, but know that that's everybody's work to create inclusive spaces. Sort of let's train more people to do that. And then they get to the value of deeper connections at work.
One of the things that I appreciated about COVID was, and I remember writing an article about it at the time, was the fact that all of the names that we were seeing in the media as, like the scientists and the researchers and the medical people and all those things is A, how many of them were obviously women? How many of them had names that I could not pronounce, which meant they could be of any culture? And given that I probably also couldn't define gender, I just loved the way that we were just ex well, what's the word I'm thinking of? Is really using them as examples of like, it doesn't matter what your culture is, what your gender is, what your anything is, you are a brilliant person doing this amazing work. And, you know, it was
Let's
just,
create knowledge together, right?
And let's just get rid of all those isms, because what matters is what's at hand and what you're doing. And you know, as I say, given the fact that I can look at that name and not have a clue what culture they're from, what their gender is, what, you know, anything is, it's, yeah, it was, I appreciated that about COVID. So
Yeah, we've all learned some interesting lessons from that. Yeah.
yeah. Now, you've just written a book, Leading with Courage, A Career-Long Guide for Idealistic Women. Now, it's October as this conversation goes live. Is that book published yet?
Yes. Yes, I'm excited. I'm excited about that. It's in
Okay.
the world in October. So.
And is it available, going to be available at all the usual places?
Yes, it should be available at all the usual places, and I hopefully your local bookstore, which I love to promote.
Okay, and speaking of promoting local bookstores, I have learned that if you go into your local bookstore and you do not find your book, you ask them to order it in, and if you recommend it highly enough, they will bring in two, three, four, or five.
Yes.
So, yeah, don't just walk in and go, oh, I guess I have to go to Amazon after all.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like,
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, I'm very excited about the book. It's been about 5 years in the making, and it is really organized around career stage. So we've been talking a little bit more about older women and younger women, but the women in between are actually probably the longest the longest section of the book. And that so it's really looking at how to be a lifelong inclusive, courageous leader and empower yourself. And I, as a woman leader, so these things I see as very linked. You're empowering yourself and empowering others. And I, you know, there's a lot of conversations, for example, around servant leadership, which I think is very valuable and important. But I think we also have to think critically about, for women, there's a lot of servant kind of roles already thrust on us. And in the spaces that we often occupy, like again, social services and education and things like that, you know, we're already asked to be kind of, I don't know, not have as much a voice or be subservient. So I try to look at empowering ourselves as women, but also being inclusive and building inclusive communities and creating workplaces that are better civic spaces. And then I talk about how there's sort of different developmental tasks or opportunities at different stages of career. So when you're young, you're establishing your confidence, hopefully, your voice. You're maybe dealing with that gender gap in confidence. You're trying to understand, especially if you're coming out of college and you have a lot of high ideals, as we most many of us do, you're trying to work with systems that you can see a lot of flaws in, leaders who are maybe a different age and generation. You're trying to find your way into that. And so I'm trying to encourage finding mentorship, as well as honoring your questions and building coalitions and finding ways you can build your confidence. And I do a lot of like building out what are the systems we need to be aware of in workplaces. And then I talk about kind of mid-career as inclusive leadership, having an expanded platform, an expanded network, but also we often get good at a number of things and then people ask us to do all of them. So how do we set boundaries? How do we use any platform or power we may have to help others, to promote diversity, equity, inclusion, to bring up young people, to have conversations, you know, to empower older people, like we were talking about. Often in that part of career, there's more caregiving needs also. So I have a lot on caregiving. That's definitely part of my expertise is the gender and caregiving piece and how that plays out in workplaces. And then the last part of the book is kind of that reimagining, rejiggering your role in the final chapter of your career, thinking about your legacy, what you've been able to do, reflecting on that, making connections with younger generations. I write about how when I turned around the age of 50, and I was still a professor and department chair at that time, I thought, I'm tired and I want more consulting and less heavy lifting in the way my work goes. And although I couldn't always achieve that, it was a very important piece of intentionality for me to realize And I didn't mean like, now I am a consultant professionally, but I meant even in my role at the institution that I had knowledge and wisdom that I could share, but I didn't have to, I could share it without and let other people fill in some of the energy required to do projects and be more of a mentor and less of a, oh, I better do that. I better do that. I better do that too. Again, I didn't always achieve that, but the intentionality helped me achieve more of it. And so I talk to my readers about how we can think about that and how we can honor at towards the end of our careers, like I mentioned. Where are we? Is our health or our family health requiring us to slow down or step back or decelerate? Or are we, as I mentioned before, perhaps ready to accelerate and really lean in and really hone and solidify the legacies that are important to us? Those might not, some of the projects or departments or whatever that we may have been involved in, or even the companies or whatever we've worked at may be gone. But what is our legacy? Is it partly the people that have been influenced by working with us? Is it maybe coalitions we've built or networks? Is it new conversations? Is it new protocols? What is it that we've accomplished that we can take pride in and reflect on it and think about what we can do with that? What do we have left to share and what are we ready to let go of?
And I'm just, as you're talking, I'm thinking there could be a listener out there who says, well, I'm not really in the workplace anymore, so probably don't need to pick up the book. But what I'm thinking is, we've been talking all through the conversation about how the lines between our personal selves and our professional selves get blurred, or those roles get blurred, between the two. But also, I also interviewed people about menopause, and that was 20 years ago. But we have daughters and granddaughters, and the more educated we can be so that we can help them and add to the conversation, then it sounds like a book that, yeah, we do need to be picking up.
I hope
So,
so. I hope it
yeah.
sparks lots of conversations. And maybe then, and you mentioned daughters and granddaughters, and we have sons. Some of us have grandsons, and I'm hoping some men will pick up the book. But I'm also, I feel like there need to be some more books on male allyship at work. And most of us hopefully have had some good ones. I know I have. But it's sort of that's like we don't name and claim that enough. And that can often happen between the cracks. But I'd love to lift up that work and empower more male allies to participate in this. But yeah, I hope people will pick up the book and have some conversations at workplaces and communities and families, wherever it seems right.
Okay, and when you write that book about male allies, you can come back and we can talk about that too. Okay, what haven't we talked about that you want us older women to think about, to embrace perhaps, as we navigate our 60s, 70s, even 80s?
Thank you for that question. It's not a workplace related necessarily, but I think that it goes back to learning from the younger generations. I think conversations about mental health are something that we could really learn from as older women, and also have our own, take on that's valid. But I feel like younger people are helping us name experiences that we have had that we didn't have names for. Nervous system dysregulation, just for example, holding space for ourselves or for other people. Some of that vocabulary, even the ability to take breaks and work with self-compassion, to know when we're exhausted. I think even, and I do, again, I'm a little bit on that cusp with being an older Gen X. I always was kind of in the tail of the baby boomers and very inspired by so many things, especially social justice wise that baby boomers did. But I think about the baby boom generation as being very socialized into constant workaholism or constant work, and I feel like we could learn, and our bodies usually make us learn anyway, how to think about taking breaks and questioning the kind of internalized capitalism of all that productivity and being hard on yourself. And I think young people have something to teach us there.
I'm glad you mentioned the mental health bit, because I know I've often thought about my father, who was already old when I was born, who A lot of what he was as a father came from his time during the war in Europe. And I often wondered if PTSD had a name in those days and he could have gotten some mental health help, would he have been a different father? And you touched on this earlier, that when we think about now the young people, and again, I'll go back to my grandson, who have real concerns about the environment, about the politics of the world, that sort of thing. That is having an effect on them that no matter what sort of a childhood we had, we can't just be saying, oh, get on with it. So we really have to hold space. Thank you for that. In both directions. So just like I forgive my father for not having PTSD as something he could hang on to and get help for, I have to also allow the younger people in my life to say, this is stressful for me, or I don't understand, or however that's manifesting in their hearts and minds.
Yeah, and I know that can be challenging for me, especially as a mother, when my children are struggling with the state of the world. I want to fix it, or part of me wants to say it'll be okay, but I don't know that, I have to hold space for their feelings and let them have their struggles. But yeah.
Okay, I'm going to give you a question that I use. Is that, as you said that, I knew exactly what I wanted to ask you, and now it's gone.
Let them have their struggles.
Well, I'll move on. It's gone. But it was so important. I'm going to have
Oh,
to
I hate
email
that.
it.
I hate
No.
that.
Ah, dear. Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
JodyVandenbrookDaves.com. I also am pretty active on LinkedIn. So yeah, you can find me there. My Modern Motherhood book is still available. I really hate the price that they've put on it as an academic press. It's even higher than it
Oh.
used to be, but it is still available. I also have a book of poems called Poems in the Mother Tongue, and then you can find my book Leading with Courage in multiple locations, as we discussed. So, but the website has some information on my coaching, consulting. I do a lot of speaking, and I also do a women's leadership intensive around some of the topics that we've talked about. And it's an online self-paced course and open to any age to talk about things like boundaries and balance and career development and mentoring and dealing with barriers and developing confidence and all those things. So
Okay, now fortunately, you just talked really fast through there because I always end with asking if I can ask you a personal question before we close. Okay, you have a book of poetry that sounds very personal.
yeah.
Can you tell us about the book and what prompted it? Both, poetry and poems in the mother tongue. It's about your time, your role as a mother.
It is about that. Primarily, although there's a lot of nature connections and things like that in there. But I've always been a journaler and sort of a poetry scribbler, I guess you could say. My poems would show up in little places in my journal or whatever. And I started collating them more towards the end of the 2010s. And I was reading some of them to my husband, and he said, "It's like you have a memoir in poems." And that sort of prompted me to go, what if I really put this together? And I'm a historian, so everything has to have a timestamp on it. So it really ended up being 2006 to when I published the book in 2019. That was a lot of time in the life of a family. So the first poem in there is about my son when he was very young, maybe, he would have been 6 in 2006, but I feel like he was even younger because he's sitting in my lap and he's got a fever. And poetry is a way to get in touch with my interior voice and other parts of me as a writer and a thinker and someone who lives in the world and in my head a lot. It's a very much a labor of love and joy to write that. I think I have another book in me. That's kind of that midlife woman thing for poet with poetry. So I love that too. Thanks for asking.
That's great. Okay, and just because we moved on to something else, I'm going to share with you now is what I say to my grandson when he says, "Oh my God, Grandma, the environment," is I'll just say, not that it's going to be okay, but these are the specific reasons why I think it's going to be okay. And so it does open up some dialogue, and if I'm wrong, then I can't be held accountable.
I mean, and giving your perspective and giving some hope, and when we all need that. Yeah.
So there we go.
That's
Okay.
great.
Ooh, got that out. Okay. Listeners, I came into this conversation today really looking forward to Jody's thoughts based on her education and vision, and she really lifts up older women. What are your thoughts? Leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. Was there a question I didn't ask Jody? Ask it in the comments and I'll get you an answer. Share this episode. I know I can rant on about ageism, but perhaps worse than ageism is internalized ageism or believing the ageism directed at you or a friend. Just like your book club, sharing this conversation will lead to a discussion which can lead to strength. You owe yourself and your friends that. So who are you going to send the link to first? And I love comparing listening to podcasts to book clubs. It's just like we've got to get more older women listening. If you appreciate this conversation, click the follow button on your favorite podcast platform. That does help us grow. I'm also registered at Substack. Following there is free, and you'll get notified every time an episode is released. Self-promotion again, check out the resource tab at boomwithabang.com. You can look up previous podcast episodes by subject. You can find books written by guests, including today's guest, and some interesting courses and offerings, lists of age-appropriate job and philanthropic possibilities. And if you're at all curious about the life of a house slash pet sitter, I'm journaling that journey on the website too. Jody Vandenberg Daves, thank you for being my guest today. You've given us so much food for thought. You've defended our wisdom. And as they say in the media these days, or at least I hear a lot these days, you brought the receipts, which is history. So thank you.
Oh, it was a wonderful conversation. Thank you for the opportunity.
Have a great rest of week.
You too.